read, read books, books.
Well, all roads lead to Woodstock, you know that, and why shouldn't they? And while you're there, why don't you, you know, read a good book, find a good book. You can also just go right to the Golden Notebook. The front door is right there, and open it up, and you're just in this wonderland of wonderful reading. James Conrad of the Golden Notebook has been keeping track of literary pursuits that are worth our time and money, and he is here to give us an update. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the program, and you've had a great summer. It's time now for fall. All the good books. I walk into all of these beautiful independent stores that we partner with, and they just have boxes upon boxes that they're unpacking and putting stuff out, and it's a busy time of year. So what do you got for us?
Oh, there's a lot of great books, but let's start with The Yellow House by Sarah M. Broom. This is an amazing new memoir and a debut from this author. Briefly, in 1961, Broom's mother purchased a small house in East New Orleans, which was a part of New Orleans that was literally developed on a swamp with the promise of being this new thriving economic community with lots of jobs from corporations like Nassau. And in fact, Broom's father and brother worked there. And so the family moved in and started to fix up this house and start an addition for their rather large family. But of course, economic dreams didn't exactly pan out for this part of town. And soon after the author was born, her father died young, leaving her mother to have to work to raise a dozen children. And the house soon fell into neglect. Broom herself made it out to get to college and eventually landed in New York City, living with her sister and embarking on a journalism career. And then Hurricane Katrina happened. Miraculously, the house itself survived, as did her family, although they were severely traumatized from it all, with one of her brothers was literally one of those roof survivors you saw so much on TV. But shortly after the waters receded, the city condemned and tore the house down with truly no notice to anybody in the neighborhood. They just completely flattened all these neighborhoods, and they say they actually mailed this information to the house, but like anybody was actually there to collect the mail. But what's interesting is Broom uses this whole history of the house and her investigations into how the city got away with their neglect for the entire neighborhood and never really assisting people after the storm had passed to write this history of her family. And in so doing, the Yellow House also becomes this vehicle to tell the story of struggles of African Americans throughout U.S. history, with struggles against urban corruption, drugs, and poverty. And there's something rather subversive about her approach where she gives this small house so much meaning. But this house literally survived a hurricane. And in the author's mind, it needed to be rebuilt, at least with her own words. We also have Sarah Broom joining us at the Golden Notebook, which is very exciting. She has connections to Woodstock. And she's reading and discussing with the wonderful Abigail Thomas on Saturday, October 5th at 4 p.m.
It's October 5th at 4 p.m., and Abigail Thomas, who we love, it will be speaking to Sarah Broom about The Yellow House. All right.
Let's do a book of poetry. I always like to highlight poetry and book picks because I love poetry, and we sell a lot of them at Woodstock, a lot of books of poetry. But this book I just didn't include for the heck of it. Actually, it's one of those books that kind of just exploded in my hands as I read it. It's called Eyes Bottle Dark with a Mouthful of Flowers by Jake Skeets, who is also named Black Streak Wood, Born Water's Edge. It was one of the winners of the National Poetry Series last year, and it was just published last week by Milkweed Editions. And as a side note, it's kind of nerdy of me to point out, but Milkweed's this amazing publisher. It's a nonprofit in Minneapolis that exists on grants and donations, and so it frees them up to have full editorial power to publish whatever they want, no matter what the market says they should publish. And they do gorgeous jobs with books. This is one, too. But Jake Skeets writes from the point of view of being a queer Native American, and the poems all take place in this collection in Gallup, New Mexico, which is known as the, quote, Indian capital of the world, unquote. But the world Skeets shows us is it's actually a community more of violence and alcoholism, and yet he manages to search and find beauty in all of this, as the book epitaph promises, from here there will be beauty again. In fact, the poem titled The Indian Capital of the World is actually just a series of newspaper headlines about Native American casualties in New Mexico, like, quote, man hit by train, and, quote, woman crushed to death by semi-truck while asleep in an alleyway. And the poem ultimately ends with the headline, quote, man found dead in field, and Skeets repeats this endlessly at the end and then slowly adds in the phrase, among flowers. He goes to imagery that in these collections that are involve trains, people's eyes and mouths, and the dichotomy of hands that can hold things as well as be fists, which is important because he sort of endlessly is searching for intimacy, and especially intimacy with men. It's in a landscape of hypermasculinity and alcoholism and violence, and he wonderfully writes that, quote, men hold a hand like they hold a bottle. But ultimately, the book takes the case that beauty can be found or remembered at having once existed, no matter how briefly, and he writes in the final poems collection of the collection in the fields, quote, he, still a boy, dug from cactus skull, undresses into bark beetles. He unlearns how to hold a fist with my hand, bursts into dandelion seeds. We are all beautiful at least once.
That is beautiful. It is eyes bottle dark with a mouthful of flowers. That is a gorgeous title.
Isn't that wonderful? Yeah, it's just terrific.
Very, very poetic,
yeah.
Actually. Jake Skeets. Okay.
All right, we'll stay out west for a moment. We'll talk about This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West by Christopher Ketchum. This is an amazing debut piece of nonfiction by Ketchum, who's actually a resident of the Catskills, and he's been a long-respected journalist for Harper's and the National Geographic. And he's a big outdoor enthusiast for hiking and camping out alone in remote areas out west. And at the beginning of the book, he starts up with a new girlfriend, and they are out east, and he just convinces her to jump in the car and head out west. And he heads out there, but what he's seeing is on these supposedly protected federal lands is actually rather criminal, and it's just getting worse. Our country probably holds over 500 million acres of public lands. National parks only make up a small percentage of this. But unfortunately, the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management are endlessly sort of caving into the interests of oil, gas, and mining and lumber. And now, of course, the current administration is aggressively trying to roll back a lot more protections and allow for more development in industry. And to be fair, Ketchum even critiques the Obama administration for their 8 years where they didn't do enough to protect these vulnerable lands. But what's great about his book is that he takes you along for the ride in being educated in just what protecting the environment really means. He sees firsthand what the cattle industry has done to the environment, how they pollute water and mow down essential plants and grasses that are there to sustain the ecology. And keep in mind that the Western cattle industry really just makes up a tiny percentage of our food market. So the whole sustaining of this industry is really just this lobbying stronghold in Washington. But Ketchum also gets schooled by various people like Dr. Mary O'Brien, who's a botanist in Utah. And if you're ever out west and look at the landscape, it can be very deceptive. You look out and you think what you're seeing is natural desert, arid landscape, but in fact, you most likely aren't. And Dr. O'Brien shows the author how sensitive this environment is when she shows him this small area that's completely fenced in and protected and has this wide variety of plants. And then the rest of the area around it is completely scarred and beaten down from industrial abuse as well as things like just human recreational vehicles. And Ketchum's main point is that we have allowed the conservation movement to really fade in importance in our lives and in national politics. And because of this, he calls for a radical change to save what's left. He calls for abolishing grazing on public lands, decommissioning roads and national parks. What he really hopes for is a public lands movement that is focused on grassroots organizing and public education. And ultimately, this book puts Ketchum as someone who's poised to kind of be a present-day Edward Abbey or Rachel Carson, and we can only hope this will inspire a whole new generation of conservation in our country.
This Land by Christopher Ketchum is the name of the book. All right, next.
Trick Mirror by Gia Tolentino. This is a kind of a surprise bestseller at our store, but when you pick it up, you'll kind of know why. Tolentino is this young journalist who has primarily written for the internet and was an editor at Jezebel and contributed to many other sites. But more important, she is young. Her life story kind of encompasses the entire life of the internet. And it's interesting to read someone who's never not known life without it and hear her discuss the changes to it, how it sort of started as this hopeful frontier of all good it'll bring to us and how it sort of turned into this dark thing with scams and trolls and how it can consume your free time and take the place of actually socializing and participating in the world by just having you endlessly sit and scroll through social media feeds. That's all the first essay of the book, which is terrific. Tolentino was also cast in high school on a reality television show, Girls vs. Boys Puerto Rico. And this gives us another terrific essay on the whole culture of reality television and how people being a part of this world really don't even have any differentiation between what is real and what is produced anymore, and that they sort of strive to be a part of this whole culture. To back up, the phrase Trick Mirror is from one of her Jezebel pieces, where she said that women were looking to feminist websites to provide a trick mirror of flawlessness as well as a self-punishment of finding fault. And this is what she sort of carries throughout the book when she discusses technology and present-day feminist issues. In one of the most powerful essays in the collection, Tolentino revisits her college, the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And years after graduating, she was working at Jezebel, and the Rolling Stone magazine piece came out about the brutal gang rape of the student at the UVA fraternity. And the story all fell apart and was later retracted. But again, it's kind of another trick mirror where Tolentino uses this quote-unquote false accusation as a significant moment in the change of how rape culture, especially at colleges and fraternities, was viewed and hopefully will start to be policed. And it started a conversation with a lot of women about how they viewed some of their own bad experiences, some even with forced physical contact. And though the Rolling Stone article was ultimately not what it said it was, it allowed for women to open up about things like roofied drinks and the pressures of sex in the fraternity culture. Anyway, it's a terrific book, and I just loved it.
Trick Mirror by Gia Tolentino.
Is it Gia? Did I say it wrong?
No. What did I say?
I said Gia, you're right.
Yeah, Gia.
I think when you say Gia, I look at see a G, and it's with a J. So
yeah, Gia. Okay.
Gia, you're right.
Excellent. Next up.
Let's do some fiction. I was surprised last week your bookseller here didn't do Margaret Atwood's The Testaments. But I'm not going to do it either. First of all, I haven't read it because it was just released. So how could I even have squeezed
how
it in a week?
How can you begin to talk about it?
I know. Yeah. But apparently some embargoes are there for reasons, some aren't. But we won't get into that. But instead of The Testaments, I want to do The Warehouse by Bob Hart, which is a little on similar ground. I'm generally not a reader of dystopian types of thrillers. But last spring at the Book Expo in the city, the editor of this book gave a talk, and he's also the editor of some pretty big books like The Martian and Ready Player One. So I thought I'd take the arc and give it a try, and I couldn't put it down. It's basically this sci-fi futuristic fiction story involving an incredibly large online retailer that takes over the world. The company is called Cloud, after they have basically turned all the towns into ghost towns due to them killing off all commerce, be it mom-and-pop shops, to just any type of capitalistic competition. They create these large campuses around their warehouses so that their workers actually live where they work in their jobs in either security or tech or service, or most importantly, picking goods up to package and put onto drones that deliver them all over the world. The story centers around a character, Paxton, who is an ex-prison guard. Prisons are one of the few industries left in this future. And he's trying to make it work in this new ecosystem, and he falls in love with Zinnia, who's a spy trying to find out secrets of this cloud corporation and with some of the irregularities of their energy consumption. And you add this to the character Gibson, who's the head of the whole company, and he's dying and he needs to name an heir. And in his chapters, we meet this man who his goals were, I really just want to make this world a better place with this whole cloud thing. But at the same time, he's tripped up with all of his own ambitions and wants to be the biggest and the best of everything. And so he kind of destroys everything in his path. And meanwhile, outside of these campuses, there's global warming and bands of revolutionaries have to survive not only being hunted by the cloud, but also have to survive the heat. And obviously, there's a lot of reasons why a bookseller who doesn't normally read dystopian future fiction might enjoy this, but I think a lot of people find it fun for a lot of reasons, mainly because a lot of things in this book at the Cloud Corporation are already true, like how they track your interests and tastes through your actions on the internet and manufacture a kind of life for workers where they feel safe and they don't want to break rules because they're provided with leisure rewards. And in fact, a revolutionary early on in the book says to Paxton, the main character, you won't be able to order A Handmaid's Tale or Fahrenheit 451 at Cloud because they banned them. And Paxton actually finds they weren't banned, but none of the workers just actually want them because they are just so sort of lulled into their complacency of their lives. Anyways, despite the depressing parts, it's actually a really great book, and so head to your local bookseller and buy it. I don't know if a online retailer will deliver it in their drones, but get it there.
It's The Warehouse by Rob Hart. Next up,
Jacqueline Woodson with Red at the Bone, just out today. I think we all know Jacqueline Woodson as this award-winning young adult writer who a few years ago started to write adult fiction, too. I did her book, Another Brooklyn, here on Book Picks, and it's exciting to have her new one here today, Red to the Bone. It's like Another Brooklyn in being a short novel, but how she manages to get in so much history with her characters in such short words and paragraphs, it'll completely entrance you. Like in 25 pages, you can read in like 15 minutes and you'll hear the entire story of a single mother on federal assistance who may or may not have to prostitute herself to keep her and her son fed at times. And Woodson gets all this history in and all the emotion that goes along with it with such a short chapter. And this novel is really about an unwanted pregnancy between two different families. One, the very poor family I just mentioned. The other, a slightly better off one that's Catholic. And this family quickly moves to a brownstone in Park Slope away from their judgmental neighborhood in Bushwick the moment they find out their 15-year-old daughter is pregnant. But in one of the twists of the story, and there are many, it's that the pregnant daughter demands to keep the child, and then once the baby's born, she goes off to live her own life, going off to college finally and living her own dreams, but leaves the father to move in with her own parents to raise the girl. And a lot of this happens to these characters, the parents, the grandparents, the child, in their different points of view, and they get to sort of describe their own stories and their own sides of it all. And Woodson does all of this in her signature style of big paragraph breaks between every paragraph, so you get the sensation, it's kind of like an ongoing editing process where the lives are still lives going on in these scenes, and you have to look really hard at every gesture and piece of dialogue as something important. And it creates a rhythm as you read. And like Another Brooklyn, you could probably want to read this in one sitting or over a day or a weekend, so get a copy now, it's out.
It's a beautiful book. She's going to be on the book show in a couple of weeks, and it's just terrific. We talk about, in the interview, we talk about her use of italics. It's really fascinating. She doesn't use quotation marks. She only uses italics.
Yeah.
And the book is beautiful. And as you said, they just pack so much in a few pages.
So much. Like, you read this book and you're just like, oh, my God, I can't believe that entire chapter.
It's
just
a gorgeous, gorgeous novel.
Yeah, amazing.
It's read at the bone. All right, next up.
All right. Finally, I have Overthrow by Caleb Crane. This is another novel. It's been compared to 19th century style novels, and I can sort of understand the comparison, as Crane writes in a very classic narrative style. The characters are introduced to each other and get to know each other sort of just as you're reading along. There's long descriptive passages with lots of big words. But what Crane seems to really be up here, it's a kind of modern-day Henry James sort of reference to style. The story follows actually a working group involved in the Occupy Wall Street protests that happened about 10 years ago. And there's a mix of people in this working group, a newly in love gay couple, a more upscale kind of do-gooder woman. But most interesting, there's a couple of mind readers in the group, and they have this interest in trying to overthrow the government by using their telepathic skills to basically hack into the systems, and that's sort of the main action of the novel when they get arrested and all that transpires. But for me, what really works with this classic style of Crane's is that when he presents the scenes that occupy protests or incorporates the characters' political beliefs into the storyline, his classic narrative style allows you to sort of be with all these protesters and hear their points of view, but you're at a bit of an arm's length so that you don't feel you're being directly preached to. And I'm a big admirer of writers who can bring in politics, no less political protests, into fiction without being so heavy-handed, like The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay about the AIDS protests in Chicago, or Richard Powers' Overstory and the environmental protests of the Northwest. He did those superbly. But if you're looking for a good classic-style read, but also covering contemporary topics like hacking or attempts to overthrow first-world governments, this is the novel for you.
It is Overthrow by Caleb Crane, and that is out as well. See, all kinds of good stuff coming out. What else would you like to tell us?
That's all I got.
All right.
I think I'm wrapped up.
Don't forget the event on the 5th of October, Sarah Broom talking to Abigail Thomas. The Yellow House is the name of the book.
Yes.
October 5th. You can find out more by going to the Golden Notebook, goldennotebook.com. For goodness sakes, you can visit them as well. They're right on Tinker Street in Woodstock, New York. James Conrad, it's always good to see you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it.
A great pleasure. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.